Did you know that the average white-collar American worker receives 200 emails every day? I learned that from John Freeman's new book, The Tyranny of Email, along with many other facts about this astoundingly popular form of communication. He argues that all that email is decreasing our attention spans and our ability to empathize with others. Mr. Freeman, who spent 6 years on the board of the National Book Critics Circle, is now the editor of the U.S. branch of Granta, the British literary magazine. His book is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hi.
Hi, nice to be here.
This is a kind of a tirade against email, but you can't be against all forms of electronic communication. Doesn't Granta have a website and even an application for the Kindle?
We have all that. We actually have a Twitter feed. We have a Facebook page. I email every day with the editors. The whole point of my book is not to say don't email at all. Email is hugely important, and it's essential for work life, and it puts us in touch with people as never before. We just use it too much, and we're using it to the exclusion of lots of other forms of communication that I think could mean more.
Well, you say that email creates a communicative rat race. The faster you can communicate, the more messages you'll send and the more time you'll spend communicating.
Yeah, we're never going to get to the bottom of our inboxes. I think it's time to sort of realize that. Back in the heyday of the telegram, the best telegram operators were sending around 300 to 400 messages a day. Those were the sort of meth addicts, if you will, of the telegram, who would do this for a couple years and move to another city. They had alcohol problems. Their families broke up. We're now approaching that level, but we're actually supposed to create the messages. We're supposed to respond to messages. We don't write these in code. We're supposed to write them in English. Sometimes we fail. I think that we need to realize that there is a sort of biological limit to how much we can communicate.
On the other hand, isn't it getting us back to writing? There was a time when people complained that the telephone had eliminated writing for many people.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the history of communication. There's this constant back and forth between oral and written communication. And yes, email and texting and Facebook and Twitter are moving us back to a sort of text-based world. But my argument is that not everything needs to be done over text, and actually it's not the most efficient way to do it. And so sometimes if you have something urgent, actually just walk down the hall to your coworker or pick up the telephone. Those things will get you there a lot faster.
Well, you're talking about a small group of people who are addicted to email.
I'm talking about the average office worker is going to send and receive 200 messages a day and spend 40% of their day doing it.
So you say this destroys productivity because it's spending too much time on the email and not enough time on the other things they're supposed to be doing?
Yeah, because it breaks up your attention during the day. If you keep your email box open and try to use that as your priority list, it basically obliterates anything you come into the work day wanting to do if you start to use your email as a priority list.
Well, there are some people who just rely on it more than others. I was at dinner last night at a gala for a very worthy organization, and one of the people at our table, a powerful man, was constantly checking his email throughout the meal. I considered that, and I think everybody else at the table considered that to be a little rude.
Yeah, I think we have this idea that we can sort of blend the virtual and real worlds because we spend so much of our day now in a kind of virtual space communicating over a computer, and we can't. If you check your email in the morning before you go to work, if you check it at night while you're around your family, you're not blending those two things. You're basically removing yourself from the actual world, and that's when it begins to be rude.
You cite Susan Sontag's On Photography, arguing that email has done for words what photography did for images. What do you mean by that?
Well, she very rightfully so pointed out that before photography, when people witnessed something or they saw it or they traveled somewhere, the way that they captured the image is they remembered it or they wrote about it or they wrote a diary about it. But there wasn't this idea to sort of collect all the things we had seen or all the most important images of the world in an image. And with words, I think we're doing something quite similar in that we don't have to have everything that we've ever experienced or thought down in words. We can have thoughts without actually communicating them. And we have so many different ways of projecting ourselves outward through text now, through Facebook, Twitter, email, and we're trying to kind of create a written record for everything we've done, and we don't need to do that. That's what memory's for.
Well, didn't Sontag then backtrack on her arguments after she realized the importance that photographs had for recording what was going on in Bosnia.
Yeah, she did, and that incredible book. But you know what we're doing with words. I'm not saying if someone is in a war zone and they need to communicate with someone, not to email because it's tyrannizing them. What I'm just saying is that by virtue of the overmuchness of this communication, of relying so heavily on text, we're actually occluding our ability to have a deep experience.
Well, why do you think that people have this impulse to record pretty much every passing thought nowadays?
Well, I think if you look at the World Wide Web, so many of the most heavily trafficked sites on it begin with a version of My or I, MySpace, iTunes, the iPhone. We're working in a universe which is more and more geared towards the self, and even the way we experience news and gather knowledge is self-driven. I mean, instead of getting a newspaper in the morning, you're shopping for news. Instead of going to the library, you have Google, which is sort of a self-driven epistemological tool. You are in the driver's seat for so much, and I think that is often to the exclusion of a group experience. And so email, blogging, using Facebook, we have broadcast tools now which were often in the past in the hands of media people. But we can't all be broadcasters, because if all of us are shoving ourselves out into the world via these tools, no one's going to listen to anyone else. And so there does need to be a winnowing. And
this is democratizing, some people would say.
Yeah, I mean, there's two answers to that. One is that the digital divide still does exist. Use of the internet and email goes down with age and also with socioeconomic value. So if the busboy at the bodega downstairs who's making eggs for people in the morning is not on email, but the person in the office is. And so we're creating separate worlds. And so, yes, phones make things cheaper, but you do have to be connected to a machine in order to use all these tools. And the machines cost money. And so I think people should just use email a little less.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke to the writer Donna Fenn, who claimed that the younger Facebook generation is more social, more team-oriented than previous generations. She said that's because of digital media.
Hmm. Well, I do think digital media, to some degree, does inspire this idea that the gathering of knowledge and experience happens collectively. Oftentimes, you sort of spread something out into the world in order to solve a problem. Like, if you want to find out information for something, you email five of your friends, and then some of them comes back, rather than going to a traditional news source or knowledge source like an encyclopedia. That's an interesting thing. But my point in the book is simply that in order to email, in order to be on Facebook, in order to be on Twitter, but email primarily, you have to remove yourself from the actual world, and the time that we spend using these tools, either in the office and outside of the office, is often coming from time that we'd spend in face-to-face interaction, where we have a richer array of emotional valence. You have your face, the tone in which you speak, the intonation of your voice, what you're wearing, your body language, even the blind talk with our hands. And when we use these tools to the exclusion of real-life experiences, we're often communicating in sort of an emotional blackout.
Which leads to the tyranny of email,
suggests. Disinhibition. You know, a lot of people will say things over email or computer-mediated communication that they won't say in person, and there's a reason for that. There's no face on the other end of the line to sort of stop them mid-sentence to say, you know, this is actually probably inappropriate or not exactly the nicest thing to say to somebody.
My guest is John Freeman, who's written The Tyranny of Email, The 4,000-Year Journey to Your Inbox. The book is published by Scribner. When you refer to Plato's cave analogy in The Republic, you seem to suggest that the written word originally led people out of darkness into the light. But what about the point that Plato makes through Socrates in Phaedrus that writing is evil because it allows them a crutch so that they don't have to rest on their memories?
Well, that's a traditional dialectic, if you will, because it's true. The writing in some ways does pull you out of the world in the same way that I'm saying that all these tools do. And even if you're writing a letter versus, say, an email,
And by the way, using technology, whether it's a pen or a pencil or a key or a typewriter, how is that all that different than a computer keyboard?
Well, I think the difference between, say, a written letter and a postcard and an email is enormous, because if you're writing a letter, you're writing on a piece of paper which was once organic material and was part of a tree, part of the earth. If you're using a paper, piece of paper with a pen, you feel the friction of the paper. Your hand moves quite a bit slower. I think sort of the speed of the human hand on across a page is sort of the speed of the deepest form of thought in a way.
So you're one of those people who argues that writers, there are writers out there who say, I have to do my first draft in longhand, and then I can put it onto a typewriter or a computer and do my edits there, or my second draft, my third draft there. Yeah.
Well, I don't write that way. I take notes that way, and then I incorporate it into what I'm working on. But I do feel like the friction with another object in the act of writing is sensual in a way, and I feel like it's important.
You mentioned postcards, and in the book you say that some early 20th century people decried the rising popularity of postcards.
Yeah, it's funny to think, but postcards are actually a relatively recent invention. They didn't come to this country until the 1870s. And basically overnight, it went from nothing to 1 in 8 Americans sending a postcard every day. And columnists were decrying the lack of civilization in this tool and felt like sort of letter writing standards had gone down. And the funny thing is, in researching the history of written communication, I discovered that at each new form of technology that comes along, whether it's, say, a postcard or a telegram.
Well, the Twitter now.
Or Twitter.
Postcard is a Twitter, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
except it takes longer to get to you.
Actually, I discovered, I tried to write 140-character messages on a postcard when I was on a trip recently, and I realized it was almost like a form of haiku, limiting the word count. But it is about the same amount of space, unless you're one of those people who really try to cram it in. But all along the way, people have anxiety about new forms of writing. And our response to email is part of that. But my argument is that we've reached terminal velocity in communication.
I want to get back to the Plato argument, because there are people who feel that writing anything down has destroyed the oral tradition.
Mm.
And there are cultures that rely on the oral tradition. But I've thought a lot about this. I've thought about what would have happened if somebody hadn't written down Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. Knowing what I know about the game telephone, by now that war would have taken place, I don't know, in Siberia, and it would have been a whole bunch of different people, and everything would have changed.
Or what about the Bible? Or what about poetry? I mean, knowledge has in the Western cultures and many other cultures, has traveled and been recorded and preserved, as your previous guest described at the Met, through writing, through putting works down on paper. And that's just the way our civilization is built. And we're moving more and more towards a digital civilization, which is ones and zeros. And who knows how well many of the archives that are being hoovered up by Google and other information sources, is how long they're going to last. There was a great book called The Future of the Past by Alexander Stilla, which investigates all this. And what he found, which I found really interesting, which is the sources and the ways that information was preserved in the past are actually more durable than the ways we have now.
In fact, I've recently had a photographer tell me that every 5 years, it was a film editor, Thelma Schoonmaker. Mm. Every 5 years, we should transfer our digital photographs to another drive, because they're going to deteriorate otherwise.
Yeah, well, we're approaching a sort of perpetual palimpsest situation where, human civilization is constantly having to redefine and re-mythologize itself.
You also mentioned the 20th century critic Walter Benjamin, who wrote about the idea of the aura in his essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. What happens to aura in the age of email?
It becomes the frequency with which your screen vibrates to create that sort of glowing light. I mean, I think that's a huge loss. I believe that when you communicate, it's not so much the information that you're passing along. It's also the way in which it travels. And some forms of communication, some messages, I love you, I miss you, I deeply regret what just happened, do not travel in the best format electronically. And they need to have the aura of thoughtfulness, an aura of deep sensitivity. And I think those can be best created in print and in pen and paper.
Well, Benjamin was even talking about having being present in front of the thing, that something has changed when a work of art is reproduced.
Yes.
You lose the aura of the original piece being there, although another kind of aura is created.
Well, that's one of the things I find so interesting about email, is that we have lots of fonts we can use on the screen, but most of us use only a small number of fonts. Our emails can be passed along, and they often are, very easily. No one would take a very personal letter and Xerox it 125 times and spread it around the globe. But, you know, and with email, you're sort of one or two missteps away from worldwide humiliation in some ways.
Is email any more life-changing than Gutenberg's development of the printing press?
Well, that's an enormously huge invention, and that just completely changed the way that people gathered knowledge and participated in civic society. And so I don't know if email is quite that important, but it is, in terms of the history of written communication and writing person to person, I think it is a watershed, because, like I said about the telegram, you know, no one sent and received 200 telegrams a day unless they were enormously important or were gambling in lots of different sources, because, you know, the telegram is used for gambling. But we're getting 200 emails a day, and we're getting them in our back pocket. We're getting them at work. We're getting them at home. We're getting them on a screen. And there's some strange facts. We spend more time with our computers now than we do with our spouses.
You offer readers advice on how to limit the influence of email in their lives.
Well, I didn't feel like I could write this book and sort of go back in time and tell the history of written communication and then analyze what email had done to us without saying, okay, here's some things that can help. And so the first thing I say at the end of the book is don't send an email. Not all emails need to be sent. You know, a lot of things that we type and send over email are just like electronic fidgets. You know, there are ways to sort of feel busy. But the problem is that goes to someone, and they type it back to us, and they type it to someone else, and it creates this sort of collective procrastination tool, which is overwhelming people. So don't send it.
Do you think there is a chance of turning things back?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there's anything that distinguishes human beings from other forms of life, it's that we have the ability to make choices. We do have instincts and sort of chemical dependencies and all sorts of things that do condition us to respond certain ways, but we can make a choice. And I'm saying, don't turn it on in the morning and check it. Don't turn it on at night. Think about it before you send it. Read it before you reply. They're all quite simple things, but they will have a huge impact on how much email you get.
Now, I don't know whether I'll be here in 20 years, but I suspect there'll be somebody like you here decrying some other advance in technology and saying, the good old days when we just emailed.
I hope not, because I really don't see how the current situation is sort of tenable for much longer. I mean, people are overwhelmed. They're working too much. They're trying to blend their home life with their work life. The eight-hour day was a response to the Industrial Revolution. We've gone through another revolution, the Information Revolution, but we haven't had a response yet. And so the reason I wrote this book was to try to at least start that conversation, because I didn't see it happening elsewhere.
There is the other side of this. I don't check my email all the time, and people get annoyed with me sometimes. It's the equivalent of not having voicemail. Mm-hmm. You know, I called your home, and the phone just rang and rang.
Well, I say that, you know, if you're getting a lot of email, put an out-of-office message on your machine so that when people email you, it comes back to them and say, I get a lot of email. If you want to reach me, call me at this number. It's pretty simple.
John Freeman is an award-winning writer and book critic who's written for numerous publications, including New York Times Book Review, Los Angeles Times, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal. He is now at Granta, and his book, The Tyranny of Email, The 4,000-Year Journey to Your Inbox, is published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.